Government officials often view religious freedom as that pesky thing guaranteed in the First Amendment that has little real-life impact. What would happen if they viewed it as the foundation of freedom for any country and a vital part of our national security? I'm Stuart Shepard, and this is First Liberty Live. Before we get started, would you do something for me? Please like and share this video. You are an important part of this project, and we do appreciate your partnership with us. And that's how we get to meet new people and grow the program. So thanks in advance for doing that. Our guest today is Thomas Farr. He's president of the Religious Freedom Institute. He's a leading authority on international religious freedom. In fact, he was the first director, I want to make sure I get this right, of the State Department's Office of International Religious Freedom. Hi, Tom. Welcome.
Great to see you. See you, Stuart.
Now, you're here because you got to speak with our fellows yesterday. The Religious Freedom Institute and First Liberty Institute partnered together on a fellowship program. What'd you think yesterday?
Well, we had 8 students from around the country. I was really impressed with them. And we began when they went around telling me about their own projects. And they were really impressive. And then we had a talk about religious freedom domestically and in the world.
Because we partnered together on that, It's free for them to participate. Why is that important to you to do that work as part of the RFI?
Because we want to educate people. First Liberty, of course, does excellent work in the courtroom as well. Our lane is education, and this is just what we do all over the country. We bring students to Washington. We go to them on their campuses. And our goal is to explain why religious freedom is such a precious right for them. It's getting a bad rap in the United States, unfortunately, and that's what I hope we can talk about today.
Yeah, let's unpack that a bit. You wrote a highly regarded work, a book called World of Faith and Freedom. The subtitle caught my eye because it says, International Religious Liberty is Vital to National Security. Now, a lot of us hear that and we're like, I don't get the connection, I don't get the link. Unpack that for us. How are the two connected?
Well, if you think about it, it's really common sense. I mean, I can cite statistics and modern research and history, but if you consider it, countries that have religious freedom tend to be more stable. They tend to have less religious violence, more political and social stability, and they actually have more economic growth. We learned this in America when William Penn, who founded Pennsylvania back in the 17th century, put out flyers saying, come to Pennsylvania, it's good for commerce, it's good for business. So that's why I say this is not rocket science. It really makes sense. If you're a company that wants to invest somewhere, you're not going to go where there's religious violence or any other kind of violence. But here's the most important thing. Research shows that countries that have religious freedom are far less likely to incubate and export religion-related terrorism. So here we're talking about 9/11, we're talking about Afghanistan, Iraq, and it's very interesting and I think encouraging that we have in our country an Office of International Religious Freedom, the one in which I was honored to serve, and we have a law that tells us to advance religious freedom in our foreign policy.
Yeah, and we can see that right now in the headlines with what's happening in Afghanistan as the troops are being withdrawn, the Taliban is regaining ground, and we're going to start seeing trouble again there, which is going to unsettle that whole region the way that it's headed. Yeah, right. You make the case that over the course of many years, our foreign policy has been aggressively secular, is the term that you use. It's something that's at odds with our own national model, which puts religious freedom at the very top of the Bill of Rights. Now, in the last administration, we saw Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and also Ambassador Sam Brownback, who brought this back to a headline item. But that's really an anomaly. When you look over many years and many presidents, that's not how it's usually done.
Quite right. Well, let me just say one thing, and I want to answer that because it's a very important question.
Yeah.
Whether it's an anomaly or not is the question. We're going to find out pretty soon. I hope it isn't. But let me just say something about Afghanistan. I mean, we've spent 20 years there. We have spent billions of dollars, and if you add Iraq, we're probably into the trillions of dollars because of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and we have shed the blood of our own young men and women. The costs have been extraordinary. Imagine if Afghanistan and or Iraq had religious freedom in those countries all along. The Taliban would never have gained control. ISIS, Al-Qaeda would never have been able to use those countries as staging grounds for attacks on the United States. So given the costs that we've incurred, isn't it a good idea to try something different that doesn't involve the use of military force or any kind of force? It involves American diplomacy. So that's why your question is so important. We saw with Sam Brownback and Mike Pompeo a real advancement of this issue in our own foreign policy. Brownback was the fifth ambassador at large. This whole thing started in 1998. So President Clinton, President Bush, President Obama, and then President Trump, he was number five, Ambassador Brownback. He took this to new heights, he and his fellow Kansan, Mike Pompeo, by having two ministerials in the State Department, in which they brought in probably 1,000 people from around the world, civil society, religious leaders, plus 100 ministerial delegations, from official delegations from countries around the world, to talk about advancing religious freedom, coming together and advancing religious freedom from countries around the world. So is this an anomaly? Will the new administration continue this? I hope so. We just don't know. They have just nominated an ambassador at large, a man whom I know and I have reason to be very hopeful about him. I was very fearful that they would bring in a person, maybe not someone of, not a person of faith, or maybe somebody who was more of a political scientist than somebody who really cared about this. So yeah. I'm optimistic, I'm hopeful, and I'm going to do everything I can to help this guy.
It certainly makes sense given that the stability of the United States, and many people don't think this way, but we do here at First Liberty Institute because it's what we do, and the people watching, I think, by and large do, that understanding that religious freedom is what allows democracy to work and to flourish. Without religion, without faith at the core of it, it takes way more government to control the populace. When we're all determining for ourselves what we're going to do and what we ought to do, then things tend to go better for an entire society.
Well, amen. That's all I can say to that. And this is what we are in danger of losing. The founders understood the value of religious freedom not only as the right of conscience, the right that each human being created in the image and likeness of God. That's what they believe. That's what I believe. I mean, that's a powerful incentive to respect the dignity of the other person and to work so that they have the freedom to find God as he wishes to be found. I mean, I'm a Christian. I believe that Jesus wants people to find him in freedom. He didn't coerce people to believe in him. He rebuked a few people, but he didn't force them to believe in him. So we should act in the same way. That's why we have religious freedom in our First Amendment. It's not just about freedom. It's about religion being in our public lives. And as you said, restricting the power of government. So just very briefly, if you believe in something more important than government, which I do, and I presume you do, and most of our listeners do, that's a limit on government. In addition, if you are inviting, by this phrase, free exercise of religion, religious actors to be involved in our public lives, which indeed the founders were, then not only do we have our churches and our synagogues and our other houses of worship, but we have people acting out of religious motives in our public lives. And guess what? For two centuries it's worked. We have the most powerful, dynamic, compassionate, faith-based civil society in the history of mankind. There's nothing close to it. Hospitals, schools, soup kitchens, homes for the sick and dying, taking care of the stranger, immigration services. All across this country, religious people are doing this. Without that guarantee of the free exercise of religion, we wouldn't have that. Yeah. So that's a limit on government, because if we weren't doing this, guess who would be doing it?
Exactly, yeah. You make a distinction between religious tolerance and religious freedom, and that's a debate that I see going on in our politics even today, where we have some politicians who, if you translate what they're saying and distill it down, they're just asking, you know, religious tolerance. You can do what you want to do inside the walls of your church. And then there's religious freedom. Unpack the distinction between those two and how that plays out in society.
Great question, because it's not only we will you know, maybe we'll tolerate you, but we'll tolerate you only if you stay within your churches and synagogues or other houses of worship. This is a right to worship. And of course we need that. That's the beginning. But that's not all the founders had in mind, as we've just talked about.
Yeah.
The free exercise of religion is a public matter. They wanted religion not only to create these institutions, but to be involved in our political life together. Politics is not a slur. It's often used that way today. It's the way we organize our lives together. If you don't have good politics, you can't have civilization. The idea that religious people should remain in their houses of worship and not be involved in our debates over laws and public policies and the public good is lunacy.
It is, indeed.
And we should not stand for it.
Yeah. You have a vantage point that few people have on this, because you've devoted your career to examining this issue, not just in the U.S., but around the world. What is the state of religious freedom in America today, in your estimation? What do you see?
Well, we are still blessed. We still have the Constitution. We have some people that I think are attacking the Constitution. And let me just say, First Liberty Institute is one of the great defenders of the First Amendment and the right to free exercise of religion. And there are other great defenders as well. But the Supreme Court is not always predictable when it comes to religious freedom. So I think the state of religious freedom in the United States is perilous. In particular, it's not to me so much an attack on religion as it is on orthodox kinds of morally orthodox religious beliefs that are getting in the way of...
Explain what you mean by that.
By that, I mean people who believe in, for example, speaking as a Christian, Jesus' teachings on marriage, on human sexuality, on the distinctions between man and woman. It's right there, by the way, in Matthew 19, 4 through 6, if you want to know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's not complicated, but people are backing away from this, and others are saying, if you don't go along with the agenda of the left on LGBTQ matters, then you need to either change or get out of public life.
Right.
Now, that's not, I mean, people are entitled to their views on this, on either side. This is America. What they cannot do, and we must not allow them to do, is tell us to change or get out. Shut up or get out. We shouldn't stand for it. And part of our problem, Stuart, is that many of us, too many of us, are standing for it. We are allowing ourselves to be silenced. We're citizens of this country, equal to all others, and we have a right, and I would argue, as a Christian, a duty to bring to bear our religious beliefs as our founders intended us to do.
Well put. Where are we most at risk right now of losing our constitutional freedoms when it comes to religious freedom in particular?
I think this is what I've been talking about is the tip of the spear, so to speak. The best example of this, in my view, is the so-called Equality Act.
Yeah.
Which is has been passed twice in the House of Representatives.
You have to say the name in air quotes every time you say it out loud.
You do, because it has nothing to do with equality. It has to do with denying the rights of people who have the beliefs that we're talking about here, these morally orthodox beliefs. And by the way, they're not just Christians. They're Orthodox Jews. There are some Orthodox Muslims who believe this way. And there are secular people who are morally orthodox. They have a right too. They have a voice in this country. So I think that's the tip of the spear. If this law passes, what it does is create a federal cause of action under the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Now, this is the narrative here is that people who believe, like I believe, speaking for myself, are like haters and bigots or even like racists. The 64 Civil Rights Act, of course, was to deal with the problem of racism. That's a lie.
Yeah.
Religious freedom protects love and compassion, not hatred and bigotry, and for goodness sakes, not racism. So this, to me, is the major threat. And the Equality Act, to me, is an example of it. If it passes, we're going to have a rough time.
And essentially, it does that by gutting the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It was passed under Bill Clinton.
Yes. If you go back, I think it's 1993 when this law was passed and signed by President Clinton. You know, presidents will give a signing statement. In this case, he was so excited about it, he gave a public speech, just off-the-cuff remarks. That speech, which I quote all the time, it could have come from me as the head of the Religious Freedom Institute. It was so vitally important, what he said. And now here we are, what, 25, 30 years later, all of this is being gutted in the Equality Act. It says you may not use the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in your defense if you are sued because you stood in the way of abortion, or you stood in the way of a same-sex marriage, or if you stood in the way of the transition of a man to a woman, or the reverse. So, for example, a hospital, a Catholic or another hospital, who says we may not, because of our religious beliefs, remove healthy organs from a woman, for example, because she's transitioning to a man. If there's nothing wrong with those organs, we can't do that. We won't do that. Well, they'll be sued, and it's already happening.
What can each of us do to engage in this conversation, in the public debate? How do we join in?
Wow. Now, that is the most important question of all. The first thing is, if you're a praying person, pray. We always do that at the Religious Freedom Institute because we know that if we get arrogant enough to think we can fix this problem ourselves, we'll lose. We'll fail. If you're a believer, if you believe in Jesus Christ, ask him to stay in front of us on this and let us follow him. If you're a believer in something else, okay, that's fine. Pray that the Lord, as you understand it, will help us here. But beyond that, again, speaking as a Christian, I believe our Lord is calling me and our organization to be public about this, to be compassionate, not angry, not shrill, not condemnatory, but to defend our faith publicly. And that's what I would ask all of those who are watching this to do. In order to do that, inform yourself. Inform yourself about what's going on in the culture. Inform yourself about the fact that virtually every culture-forming institution in our country, beginning with education, but going to the corporate world, to the media, to the entertainment world, all of them are against us on this. Of them have this narrative that we are nothing but bigots and haters.
At least that's what they say out loud. I don't know if they believe it in their heart, but they do say it out loud.
Whether they believe it or not, it's getting to our children.
Yeah.
I mean, the public schools are teaching this poison to our children. If I can tell you a brief story, there's a family in Washington State. They have a teenage son who has he has a mild form of autism. He got on the web. He was seeing things he shouldn't have seen. He got very frustrated and upset, became suicidal, so they took him to a state hospital in Washington State.
Yeah.
There, angry at the world and at his parents, he told the people in the hospital, "I believe I'm a girl."
No.
They decided that this was his problem and that he needed to transition. The next thing his parents knew, they were being contacted by the hospital saying, "Your autistic son, your daughter, needs to begin transition counseling so that we can solve this problem this way." They were smart enough to realize what was going on. They got their son out of there and they fled the state of Washington. This is like China.
Yeah.
This is not America. So here the state is substituting itself for the parents. That's un-American. We can't stand for this. We have to stand up for what we believe.
Let's talk about the Religious Freedom Institute that you head up. This image behind us is from your website. It kind of, in a photo form, it shows what you do. But I'd like you just to unpack, give me your elevator speech, what the organization is all about.
We go to targets around the world. We have action teams in the Middle East. We work in South Asia, Southeast Asia, Africa, Europe. And our model is religious freedom. Unless you're a terrorist, religious freedom is good for you and for your country, and we can prove it. Now, obviously, the next sentence is going to be different depending on who you're talking to.
Yeah.
If we're talking to the Afghans, if we're talking to the Tanzanians or the Russians, it's going to be different, let alone the Chinese. But we have an argument to make for every organization. For this country, and by the way, we're spending over half our resources in the United States rather than overseas.
That's telling.
On the proposition that if we lose this precious right here, where else can it be restored? The answer is nowhere. U.S. leadership is vitally important, which is why we hope that the work of Mike Pompeo and Sam Brownback can be replicated by their successors under the Biden administration.
I appreciate what you do, and I appreciate your making time to share with us today. A lot of good insight in there, Tom. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Stuart.
Dr. Thomas Farr. Hey, if you haven't already, I want to encourage you to go to the App Store or Google Store or whatever they call it over there in Android land and download the First Liberty Live app. It's the easiest way for you to connect with our content and to hear the stories that we tell here and get the insights that we share. It'll bring it right to you on your phone. It will let you know when new episodes are available. You can either watch it on your phone or you can play it as a podcast, just the audio, if you like to listen in your car. And thank you for sharing First Liberty Live with your friends and family. We love to meet new people, and that's the best way to do that. We will see you next time right here on First Liberty Live.